Blog Talk Radio.
And there we go.
Now we're live with everybody.
We are live with everybody. So good evening, everyone. It's Chris.
And Beth.
And Beth. Haunts of Richmond, thank you all very much for tuning in tonight. And congratulations on surviving the first month of 2021.
It's snowing.
It is snowing. We got some light snow going on all outside. And nice crisp evening. And we're in here in front of the fire with our beverages and all ready to... chat about not prime spooky season stuff, kind of, sort of.
So, disclaimer, Chris and I are not really Valentine's Day people.
No. No.
So, this was an interesting one.
We do gifting. We give each other gifts. I gave her a chop saw one year, and another year she gave me a chainsaw. So...
we give practical gifts.
Yes. The fact that they could be used in a horror film is kind of beside the point, but...
welcome to our world.
Welcome to our world, yes. So, yes. That over so sappy, mushy holiday is just around the corner. And so we're going to go ahead and share some tales with you tonight that are a little on the...
well, things didn't always work out. Let's just say it that way.
They don't live happily ever after. Here's what it is. It's kind of
a ghost story.
It's a ghost story.
Somebody's going to die.
Yeah. I mean, somebody kind of has to die in order for there to be a ghost, generally speaking, in theory. Not necessarily. Okay. That could be a whole other episode.
Yeah.
In the meantime, we have for you our haunted Valentine's, roses, chocolate, and yes. So yes, thank you very much for tuning in. We got these are some good stories. Most of them are pretty local too. Not necessarily Richmond, but from the Mid-Atlantic area. We got some stuff from here in Virginia. A couple just across the border up in Maryland.
Some up in D.C.
Yep, up in D.C. So yeah, because there's plenty of
passionate
energy. Yes, from our neighbors to the north.
And I want to go ahead and say thank you to Patrick for sending us Venmo. Thank you. That does support my research habit, which I will happily go and buy more ghost books.
Yes. So if during the show this evening, if you are if you would like to contribute to this, we do this for free. We enjoy doing this. Mm-hmm. We're very thankful for everybody that tunes in. But if you want to go ahead and chip in a little bit to help support our research
library.
Library, because we have developed quite the library of books and whatnot in doing these shows.
Let's just say we ran out of room, so we bought a business Kindle, and I'm buying Kindle editions now.
Yep. So you can go ahead, you can send us the Venmo if you have that, and the Venmo, I'll put it in the chat in a minute here too, but is at haunts-of-richmond. So if you don't mind throwing a few bucks our way, it will help support our research addiction, if you will.
Hi, my name is Beth, and I have a research addiction to with ghost stories.
That's not a problem. It's all good. We're good here. So anyway, yes, we got some stories for you tonight, and as we mentioned, we have some from up from our neighbors in the north, and this one is not quite across the border. This is all the way up, right before you cross into D.C. and up in Alexandria. So up there, just a couple hours up the road, at the corner of North Royal and Cameron Street, stands a large brick building that was a center of social and political life in the colonial era. Gatsby's Tavern is mostly known for its prominent presidential pardons over the years, but about this time each year, one of its other famous guests takes the limelight. She is simply known as the Female Stranger. Facts about the Female Stranger are few, but this is part of the fascination. Regardless of who she was, the story of her passing, subsequent interment, and her lingering spirit keeps her in the minds and hearts of many. The story starts back in 1816 as a couple arrived in Old Town Alexandria on a ship from the Caribbean. The woman, cloaked in a long black veil, was very sick, possibly from typhoid. The couple rented room 8 on the second floor of Gatsby's Tavern. Frantic with worry, the man called for a doctor and 2 nurses. When they arrived to see the patient, however, the man refused to identify himself or his companion to the attendants or to Mr. Gatsby, the owner of the tavern. The circumstances and mystery surrounding the couple quickly sent rumors flying about the woman's identity, and these rumors have never died. Some say that she is Theodosia Burr Alston, the daughter of infamous politician Aaron Burr, who we have previously discussed as a Theodosia is part of our Outer Banks episode that we did last summer. The most common tale of her disappearance is that she was lost at sea off the Outer Banks in January of 1813. However, some whispered that Theodosia had run away with a lover, and her earlier disappearance was a cover-up to hide away the scandalous relationship. Could Theodosia have lived on in secret after her disappearance only to pass away of illness 3 years later? One possibility. Another favorite explanation, though, not quite so romantic, is that the female stranger wasn't a female at all. Some believe that she was the recently deposed Napoleon Bonaparte. Now, as eye-popping and somewhat entertaining as this theory may be, it does kind of fly in the face of Napoleon's known death in exile in St. Helena in 1821. Still, kind of a fun one to throw around there. But in any case, whatever her identity is, the woman languished in pain for 3 weeks, succumbing to her illness on October 14, 1816. Just before she died, her companion asked Mr. Gatsby and those attending her to come to her bedside. Her fate was inevitable, so the couple asked those gathered to swear an oath. In that oath, they swore they would never reveal the identity of either the man or the woman. Grief-stricken, the woman's companion borrowed money from a local man and had the woman buried in St. Paul's Cemetery. Even in death, the woman's identity remained a mystery. The elaborate inscription on the tabletop tombstone is weathered and hard to see today, but it once read, "To the memory of the female stranger whose mortal suffering terminated on the 14th day of October, 1816, aged 23 years and 8 months. This stone is erected by her disconsolable husband," I have a typo in here, that doesn't help, "in whose arms she breathed out her last sigh and who, under God, did his utmost to soothe the cold, dull ear of death." Here, the story takes an unexpected twist. As grief-stricken as the man supposedly was, he skipped town almost immediately after the woman's death. He paid not a cent for the expenses that he had incurred for the room at Gatsby, the medical care for the woman, nor the funeral or burial. Alexandrians were furious, but the man had been quite clever. The only people who knew his identity or that of the female stranger had sworn an oath that they would keep their identity secret. Thus, his debts would go unpaid, and the mystery lives on today, heightened by the fact that the woman's spirit seems not to rest easy.
So there are tales of the mysterious and beautiful woman appearing in Gatsby's Tavern Museum today, especially around the room where she died, room number 8. One tale in particular comes from a tour guide who saw this female stranger enter the room, and when the guide caught up to the room, he found in a small room, nobody there, but one of the candles was lit. Now, he searched through everything, could not find the female spirit anywhere, so he went down to find the museum curator to report what he had seen. And the curator said that was not possible because he had already extinguished all of the lighted candles. Well, they both went back up to room number 8. When they got there, they discovered the candle was not extinguished, but they went to touch the candle globe, and it was still hot, as if it had just been extinguished. In fact, the curator burned his fingers. Now, they like to say that this is the female stranger leaving a beacon of light in the window for her long-lost companion to come back and find her. And that was actually pretty common back then as something to do, to light a candle in the window until all your loved ones had come home for the evening. Now, despite this generally peaceful demeanor, she has startled a few of the staff members there. A few summers back, a young woman had just returned home from college, and she took up a job as a server at the Gatsby Tavern. And as she entered the kitchen to pick up an order, she very carefully placed all the plates on her arms, and as she turned around, she suddenly faced a woman she did not recognize. And the woman said something to her and then abruptly vanished. In her terror, the server shrieked, dropped all the plates, and ran screaming from the building. None of us know what was said to her. I'd actually be really curious to find out what that was.
When that actually visited Gatsby's Tavern and the grave of a female stranger.
It's on our list. We need to get up to Alexandria, and we haven't explored there yet. Drive through it quite often.
Yes, really often, but very rarely stop.
Mm-hmm. All right, so the next one, we're going to trot down to the Great Dismal Swamp, another place we need to go and visit, just not during mosquito season for you.
Yes. This will be the perfect time of year, dead of winter. No creepy, crawly, bitey, nasty, blood-sucking things. They're all sleeping.
They like him. I'm fine as long as I'm not with him. Or I should say, as long as I'm with you. Anyway, moving on to the Great Dismal Swamp. So it stretches across the northeastern section of North Carolina up into southern Virginia, and despite its name, it is a beautiful primordial landscape covering over 100,000 acres. It makes it one of the largest protected natural areas in the eastern United States. However, this area is by no means untouched by man. The swamp has a long, complex history of human settlement and exploitation starting over 13,000 years ago. And this is back to the earliest Native American tribes. When Europeans first arrived only a few centuries ago, the swamp was almost immediately a point of fascination for them. George Washington was actually one of the earliest men dedicated to transforming the swamp into something other than a swamp. He was a major investor in the Great Dismal Swamp Company, and this company attempted to colonize the swamp by draining it and transforming it into farmland. But what happened is that it was impossible to do this. So the company then switched gears and they turned to harvesting the timber from the swamp. The industry eventually led to the creation of the Great Dismal Swamp Canal, and that was used to transport the logs from deep within the forest. It is the oldest man-made waterway in America that's actually still in use. Now, prior to emancipation, the Great Dismal Swamp served as home to a number of maroon communities, and these were enslaved people who had freed themselves and fled into the wilderness to avoid capture. These communities began springing up almost as soon as the slaves were brought into the colonies. And the importance of the Great Dismal Swamp was a place to escape and was basically widely understood because it was easy to get lost in this swamp. Today, there's a presence of these communities that's actually commemorated in a recently added Underground Railroad pavilion located near the Great Dismal Swamp National Park headquarters in Suffolk, New York. Now, while the swamp is suddenly beautiful, it's also wildly dangerous. It's easy to get lost in the maze of islands and waterways. There are dangerous animals in the swamp, and it's a very dangerous geography as well. The waters can be deceptively deep and impossible to climb out of at certain locations. And over many years, many lives have been lost to the murky depths of the water. With this long, complex, dangerous history, it's not surprising there's a few spirits in there. Now, the air of mystery that drapes itself across the swamp, often you will see mysterious lights floating through the woods and over the waters at night. Hunters have passed down stories of shooting a bear or a deer only to find that the body of the animal has vanished. It's left no trace, not even a drop of blood. And when they go to retrieve it, they can't find even footprints. There are multiple stories about people encountering phantom figures in the woods of the swamp, people dressed in everything from colonial-era clothing right up to 20th-century lumbermen. And some like to think that the spirits of the swamp are reaching out to help prevent others from joining their ranks. There's actually one legend that speaks of a mysterious traveling graveyard that can't be found when you're looking for it, and it will only appear to warn somebody if they've lost their way, so just be wary. Kind of like that room of requirement from Harry Potter.
Mm-hmm.
Except for it just tells you you're lost. It doesn't tell you how to get out. Others, stories that come, actually, there's a famous Native American one that is the longest one that we've found from that era, and from that area, excuse me. And this is slightly north of the border in Virginia where Lake Drummond stretches for 5 miles through the swamp. And it's the story of two American lovers who they were pledged to be married, but the bride-to-be actually died the morning of the wedding. And the girl was buried in the depths of the Great Dismal Swamp. Her fiancé was driven mad by grief and convinced himself that he could see her paddling up through the waters of the lake in a white canoe. So he decided that he was going to make a raft and he was going to follow this vision that he was seeing out onto the lake. Unfortunately, he drowned before he chanced to actually reach her. And ever since then, the new vision is that the two lovers are actually paddling together in a white canoe across Lake Drummond, something that would be pretty cool to go and see. Now, this is actually inspired a ballad by Thomas More, and I'm going to let Chris read this one, because I know you like the poem.
I'm sorry.
The ballad.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, the story was the inspiration for the Thomas More's poem, A Ballad, the Lake of Dismal Swamp. They made her a grave too cold and damp for a soul so warm and true. And she's gone to the lake of the dismal swamp where all night long by a firefly lamp she paddles her white canoe. And her firefly lamp I soon shall see, and her paddle I soon shall hear. Long and loving our life shall be, and I'll hide the maid in a cypress tree when the footstep of death is near. Awake the dismal swamp, he speeds, his path was rugged and sore. Through tangled juniper beds of reeds, through many a fen where the serpent feeds, and a man never trod before. And when the earth he sunk to sleep, if slumber his eyelids knew, he lay where the deadly vine doth weep, its venomous tear in nightly seep, the flesh with blistering dew. And near him the she-wolf stirred the brake, and the copperhead breathed in his ear, till he started cried from his dream awake, oh, when shall I see the dusty lake and the white canoe of my dear? He saw the lake and a meteor bright, quick over its surface played. Welcome, he said, my dear one's light, and the dim shore echoed for many a night the name of the death-cold maid. Till he hallowed a boat of the birchen bark which carried him off from shore. Far, far he followed the meteor spark. The wind was high and the clouds were dark, and the boat returned no more. But off from the hunter's camp, this lover and maid so true, are seen at the hour of midnight damp to cross the lake by a firefly lamp and paddle their white canoe. Moore's sentimental ballad was wildly popular at the time and actually spurned a small tourism boom for the Great Dismal Swamp. Moore's poem is not the only work inspired by the swamp and its denizens. In 1933, composer William Grant Still wrote a tone poem called "To Dismal Swamp," inspired by the long history of African Americans with the swamp. More recently, in 2000, a somewhat bizarre reimagining of Moore's poem came to light upon the death of illustrator and writer Edward Gorey. Now, Gorey is well known for his macabre illustrations, but he was also a playwright and a lover of opera. Amongst Gorey's papers was The White Canoe, an opera seria for hand puppets. Yes, you heard that right. The title is The White Canoe, an opera seria for hand puppets. Yes. Believed to be his final theatrical work, it was actually brought to life at the Cotuit Center of the Arts in Massachusetts 5 months after Gorey's death. Now, regardless of the medium, The Great Dismal Swamp is still inspiring people and proving that not only are there more tales from the swamp to be told, but that there are also many ways to tell them. I think it's also safe to say that if you can find love in a swamp, no matter how beautiful it might be, you can find love almost anywhere.
And those weren't the only three I found. There is actually quite a few poems and songs that were all about this one story, but those were the three I thought were kind of interesting.
Yeah,
especially the Edward Gorey.
Yeah, they kind of stand out. An opera hand puppet.
And I've actually worked on a production from Edward Gorey. Very odd. Very odd.
Now, our next stop, we are going to stay by the water, but we are going to go up the Atlantic coast to Chincoteague Island. Mm-hmm. Now, the islands along Virginia's and Maryland's Atlantic coast are marked with many notable pieces of from history, from the famous ponies that graze the shores of Assateague to the towering red and white lighthouse that greets guests entering the National Wildlife Refuge. Chincoteague also holds a hidden gem that is nestled on Main Street and that marks the last reminder of Chincoteague's original settlement. This treasure is known as Captain Timothy Hill House. Built around 1800, the petite house, measuring 17 feet 4 inches by 16 feet 4 inches, was one of 26 homes constructed after settlement began in the late 1700s. Tiny house. Now, Hill House was fashioned in an architectural style that was very common for early colonists in the mid-Atlantic and southern regions. It consisted of a wooden chimney, on the south wall, two doors, a small window, and walls planked with logs. with access to trees, the early settlers were able to construct these houses with just an axe and saw. Clay was used to line the wooden chimney to try and mitigate the risk of fire, try being the key word here. But anyway, clay still stands, so I guess it worked.
Well, at least that one does.
Yes. Now, in 1980, the land on which Hill House rested was sold, and with the sale came a new owner who wished to rid the property of the old rundown stack of logs and rebuild. Richard Vesley, the builder hired to construct the new property, saw the diamond in the rough, as well as the historical value, and opted to move Hill House to a temporary location on the west side of the island on North Main Street for safekeeping. After sitting there for about 30 temporary years, of a new location, Hill House was purchased by new owners in December of 2009, and it was set to be moved to its new home to be a storage shed. Upon inspection, a chunk of clapboard fell off, revealing wood and what looked like small carvings of colonial-era ships on the exterior. After the discovery, architectural historians inspected the building and realized that this was a historical artifact rather than a storage shed material. Now, I will say, in doing the research, I did find a couple pictures of these wood carvings, the carvings of the ships in the side of the house. They are very good carvings.
They are.
And it's a mystery as to who the carver was. We do not know exactly who did the carvings, but whoever it was had some talent. So anyway, this project was undertaken to restore the house to its former glory, and with restoration, other discoveries were made. 21 generations of paint on the front door and additional ship carvings on the exterior totaled 39 ship carvings on the outside of this house. Pretty remarkable. Now, as for Hill House's name, it originated from Captain Timothy Hill, a sailor who was shipwrecked off of Assateague and found his way to Chincoteague in 1822. There he married Rebecca Russell, and the two had six children. Hill House stayed in the Hill family until 1954, and Chincoteague is still home to many of Hill's descendants. But it is here that we will share the tale of Timothy Hill's 13-year-old granddaughter, Virginia Jenny Hill. Now, Jenny was the daughter of Timothy Hill, or Timothy Jr. and Zapporah Hill, and she was the favorite granddaughter of the captain. Her grandfather wanted all the best for Jenny, including for her to be married to a wealthy, well-educated man. The connections that her grandfather and his family had made that desire seem very achievable as well. Jenny didn't lack for admirers, and one of them was a young man named Tom Freeman, who grew up alongside the Hill family. Tom was madly in love with Jenny, but the feeling was not mutual. The captain refused Tom the right to marry his favorite granddaughter. On June 18, 1885, overcome by grief and anger, Tom ambushed Jenny and her mother. Using a .32 caliber pistol, he fired on the two women before turning the gun on himself. While her mother survives, Jenny succumbs to her wounds later that night within the walls of Hill House. Jenny's spirit is said to linger on in Hill House to this day, whether she is seeking amends for her unjustifiable death or she is pining after the promised future that she was denied is unknown. What we can say for sure is that an obsession, we dare not call this love, turned sour can be a very dangerous thing.
Yes.
Tragic tale of Virginia Jenny Hill. And you can still go visit the house up there in Chincoteague. It still stands there on Main Street. So very unique historical gem.
Yes. I did not find any evidence that somebody has gone and done a paranormal investigation there. Be cool if somebody could go do one, if we have any friends who are in that area that might possibly be able to get in there.
Mm-hmm.
Be awesome.
We'll be neat.
All right, so we're going to bounce over to Abingdon, Virginia, and this is the Martha Washington Inn. So the structure dates back to 1832, and it was built as a spacious and luxurious manor house for General Francis Preston to enjoy in his retirement after his successful service during the War of 1812. Now, the Preston family stayed at home until 1858, when it was sold to become the home of Martha Washington College. Again, 1858. Now, it's named after the first lady who was deemed the perfect model of womanly excellence. We'll get more into that next week. During the Civil War, the students served as nurses when the building was being used as a makeshift hospital. The property also became a training barrack for the Washington Mounted Rifles. In the years after the war, it resumed its educational mission, but it did serve as a hospital again during the typhoid outbreak. Eventually, the college closed in 1932, and the building remained vacant for several years before being repurposed as a housing for actors performing at the neighborhood Barter Theater. And then it opened as the luxurious Martha Washington Inn in 1935. The inn retained many of its historic details that made the building so special from when it was first constructed over a century before. In the years since its opening, it had served many renowned guests, including Eleanor Roosevelt, Jimmy Carter, and Elizabeth Taylor. If it's good enough for them, it's good enough for anybody. Now, of course, many of those who have passed through this building in its nearly 200 years, some who haven't left. Remember, it was a hospital twice. So our first story, this is known as the Yankee Sweetheart. It comes from the time when this building was the college and also the Civil War hospital. And it was a tragic love affair between a student at the college and her Yankee sweetheart. Now, because it was the hospital during the Civil War, several of the girls, as we had mentioned, volunteered to stay on as nurses. And Captain John Stowe, the Yankee officer, was severely wounded and captured in town. Soldiers carried Captain Stowe through the cave system under Abingdon and up a secret stairway to the third floor of the building. There lay Captain Stowe, gravely wounded, in what is now room 403. Now, for weeks, a young student named Beth nursed and cared for him. She ended up falling in love with him, and he also fell in love with her. Florence Nightingale. Effect before Florence Nightingale.
I mean, what's that?
I didn't nurse you to make you fall in love with me. I fed you.
You fed me, yes.
Other way to do it.
You have been nursing over the years.
I fed you first.
Yes, you did.
Anyway, back to our story. Room 403. Now, as we said, for weeks she nursed him, and she fell in love with the brave captain, and he also fell in love with her. Now, often Beth would lovingly play the violin to help ease his pain and suffering. But their love was not to last for long. As he lay dying, he called, "Play something, Beth. I'm going." Unfortunately, Beth was too late to escort him out with a song because he had died suddenly. Beth tearfully played the sweet southern melody as a tribute to him. When a Confederate officer entered and explained he was taking Captain Stowe as a prisoner, Beth faced him triumphantly and said, "He has been pardoned by a higher officer higher than General Lee. Captain Stowe is dead." Beth followed her beloved captain to death a few weeks later because she had contracted typhoid fever. Many of the female students who later attended the college, as well as the inn employees and guests, have reported hearing Beth's sweet violin music in the night. Others have also reported that she visits room 403 to comfort her Yankee soldiers.
It's a sad story. That's the theme for tonight, though. So, hey.
Love that never quite gets it.
Yeah. Now, also, we're staying there at the inn. We have our next tale starts with a young Confederate soldier in Abingdon who was assigned to carry important papers about the location of the Union Army to General Lee. This soldier was hopelessly in love with a young woman at the college, and knowing the risks he was facing, he felt he must say farewell to his lady love before leaving. The soldier traveled through the cave system underlying Abingdon and used a secret staircase to enter the college. As the soldier was saying goodbye to his love, two Union officers came up the stairs and found them. With no way to escape, the young Confederate Confederate soldier was shot in front of his sweetheart, and when he fell, his blood stained the floor. The strange thing is that though through the years, the blood stain continues to appear. Carpets over the area often develop mysterious holes over the stain. Even after the floors have been refinished, the stain continues to reappear, a sad reminder of the love that was ripped asunder during the Civil War.
So, we've had a request.
You have a request?
Hi, Preston.
Oh!
I'm going to disturb her, just so you know.
Oh, she's fine.
Come here, you. Oh, come here, pussy head. So, here's your Yonevisi.
Yep.
I will speak quicker. And Lulu is hiding somewhere.
Lulu's over here.
She's over there.
I'll get Lulu out in just a minute.
So here's a very sleepy Yuna, which is unusual. She usually is stealing the show.
Yes. Well, she's here now. She can feel the show now, can't she?
I'm going to fall asleep. Back to sleep.
So, our next stop, we are going to go ahead. We will leave the tragic tales of the Martha Washington Inn behind. And we are going to move back up the road to the north of here. And this time we're going to cross the border. We are going to go into Washington, D.C., where, as we know, there are plenty of tales of
passion and love and duels and
intrigue,
yeah,
and all betrayal and all kinds of good and bad and ugly stuff. Now, this particular story takes place. It's at the corner of 17th Street and Constitution Avenue. And this is what you might call prime real estate. Now, on the northeast corner of this intersection is the Ellipse, which is the beautiful lawn that sits immediately south of the White House. So, yeah, you're neighbors with the White House right there. And to the southeast is the Washington Monument, another kind of prominent neighbor, if you will. Southwest is the Reflecting Pool, the World War II Memorial, and a wide variety of other monuments in that immediate area.
So you got great views from whatever side.
Yeah. And, plenty of parks and other beautiful public spaces for you to go for a walk. Now, on the northwest corner, it is an impressive building that stands there today, but it is not one that's not as well known as its neighbors. Today, it is the home of the Organization of American States, and we're not talking the United States, we're not talking Virginia, New York, Nebraska, and all that. We're talking about the American states, American countries, this hemisphere. So it's a...
It was confusing at first.
Yeah, Organization of American States. It's an interesting building and an interesting organization, but even this is not the building that we are going to focus on. Very soon. So, yeah, getting a little confusing here. But anyway.
It's the building that now stands there.
This corner in the heart of the nation's capital has been prime real estate since long before the Organization of American States, and it was once home to a grand mansion that occupied the site for almost 100 years. This tale is not only about romance, but also about love of family. We start with John Peter Van Ness, a well-liked politician from New York and a protege of Aaron Burr. Van Ness was elected to the 6th Congress that convened in D.C. in December of 1799, and Van Ness quickly fell in love with the rustic federal city. This love affair with the capital was due in no small part to meeting Miss Marcia Burns, daughter of Mr. David Burns, and Mr. Burns was kind of a character in his own right, but he's best remembered for being the previous owner of much of the land that D.C. was actually built on.
And he's actually one of the ghosts from the White House that we talked about before.
We will probably cover him one day because he is quite the character. And So anyways, now he was not exactly willing to part with his property, and that's quite the tale in and of itself. He did eventually sell off his land bit by bit, making him a fantastically wealthy individual. And when he passed away in 1799, his daughter, in turn, became a fantastically wealthy heiress. Now, Van Ness and Miss Burns were deeply in love, and they soon were married. At the time, Congress would convene for only about 18 weeks or less. It took a lot more time for the congressmen to travel back and forth from their various constituencies. But rather than return to his constituents during a recess, Van Ness spent most of his time in D.C. with his love. His constituents, in turn, were not feeling the love as their representative wasn't available to them, so they voted him out in the election of 1803. He's now free to go ahead and basically stay in D.C. and do what he pleases, which he does. He doesn't care. He's in love. He contented himself with managing his wife's estate and making the entertainment rounds of the political world. He eventually decided to build his own mansion, and it was completed a few short years after the end of the War of 1812. It was the first house in America to have both hot and cold water supplied through the indoor plumbing. The north portico was modeled after the White House itself. The south side faced the river and looked over a fruit orchard. Very few homes in the area could rival. The house was furnished in time for Van Ness's daughter Anne to return home and be able to entertain suitors there herself. The home was a favorite stop of Washington's elite, including former Vice President Aaron Burr, Commodore Stephen Decatur, Congressman John C. Calhoun, Attorney General William Wirt, House Speaker Henry Clay, and many others from all three branches of government. The most lavish party thrown in the mansion was, of course, Anne's marriage to Arthur Middleton, whose father was a signer of the Declaration of Independence. Unfortunately, the saddest day also involved Anne, as she just died in the house during childbirth in 1822. The child, unfortunately, was also stillborn. Now, Anne's death draped a somber atmosphere over the home. Van Ness plunged himself into his work as the mayor of Washington, D.C., to try and overcome his sadness. Marcia did the same, but with her charitable works. Unfortunately, Marcia's grief led to her failing health, and she passed away a few short years later. The loss left Van Ness a hollow man, as he valued his family above all else. He supervised the construction of a mausoleum for his wife and daughter to rest in. It was described as an exact replica of the pillared temple of Trivoli, sitting on top of the highest hill in Oak Cemetery, looking down on Rock Creek. Once this task was completed, he began diving into his work once more. He continued to entertain at the mansion, but the sparkle had gone from his eyes. Though much of the magic was gone for Van Ness, one of the most talked about events in town was the annual banquet he held for the members of Congress. People would line the streets to catch a glimpse of the more famous statesmen as they arrived. As Van Ness aged, his home deteriorated and his mind returned more and more to the time he was happy with his family. He began to lose contact with his friends in reality. It is said that at this time, the ghost stories began to circulate about the mansion. Certain rooms were closed off and not to be entered. The room Anne died in was one of those rooms. Servants would hear her laughter evaporate into blood-curdling screams, similar to those made just before she died in childbirth. A local newspaper article mentioned footsteps unattached to human bodies. Another story discussed a small lady in quaint costume and wearing an old-fashioned bonnet wandering in the hallway upstairs. It appears to be Marcia still wandering about her beloved home. Van Ness paid no mind to the tales circulating, if he was even aware of them. He passed away in 1846. Van Ness was placed on a briar and pulled to Oak Hill Cemetery by his cherished six white horses. Even though the U.S. was at war with Mexico, Washington took time to mourn the man who had been loved by many. Many private houses on the procession route were draped in mourning. Even the horses mourned their master's passing. It was described by one mourner that the white horses were munching on the grass and lowered their heads behind the burial mound. Someone exclaims they buried their heads with their master. In the years after Van Ness's passing, his family's home changed hands a few times before being sold to the government. It was raised in 1908 to make room for the Pan American Building, which was the precursor to the Organization of American States. Though the mansion is no longer there, many have since seen the specters of six headless white horses galloping around the property, and they are almost always seen on the anniversary of Van Ness's death. Retracing this journey to Oak Hill Cemetery and circling the Organization of American States building at a gallop, searching for their master. One motorist tried to explain to police why he had run his car off Rock Creek Parkway. He had seen the shimmering forms of six headless white horses by the mausoleum. So.
Yep. So do be aware, when you're heading up to that cemetery, you might see six headless horses. It's a common sighting from what I was able to research.
Yep. All for love of family.
Yep. You know.
You can read and I will...
Yep. So I saw a comment that mentioned the plantations along Route 5, Shirley, Berkeley. We are going to do a haunted plantation coming up. I am working on that, but I believe Sherwood is actually going to be on our next stream. So we'll have one coming. All right, so now we're going to stay in D.C. and we're going to go to the Octagon House, now a museum. It is located at the corner of New York Avenue and 18th Street Northwest. It's one of the more well-known historic and haunted buildings in D.C., and justifiably so. It has been the site of numerous family tragedies. It served as a temporary presidential residence full of parties and is now, as I said, a museum. It has been reported as being haunted in over 100 years worth of news articles. That's a lot. Oh, here comes our other baby girl.
It's the Lulu.
Now, work began on the house in 1797. Major Pierre Charles Lafont had drawn up the plans for the federal city, plotted the streets at New York Avenue and 18th Street, formed an acute angle, which presented Dr. William Thornton, the building's architect, a unique design challenge. The result was a federal-style building with six sides. Why or how this became known as the Afghan is completely unknown. It took 2 years to build, and the Taylor family lived here until the death of Mrs. Taylor in 1855. Colonel Taylor and his wife had seven sons and eight daughters together. God bless that woman. Yeah. The daughters were all very beautiful and well sought after in society, and many of their love affairs were turbulent and involved dramatic ends on the huge oval staircase in the middle of the octagon. The stairwell... Ow! Those were claws. Okay, I'm sorry. Anyway. Okay, no blood. Where was it? Ah, there we go. So many of their love affairs, as I said, were ended in this oval staircase. The stairwell lantern cast shadowy light on the large statues that are set in niches on the stairwell wall, and it's a very eerie-looking space. It gives you an ominous air, and you start to realize why so many arguments and violence might have taken place on this stairwell. So in the early 1800s, one of the daughters fell in love with a British officer, but considering the hostile feelings between the U.S. and the British at this time, the colonel was not a happy man. He would not allow the gentleman to set foot inside his house. This sparked several loud arguments between the daughter and the father, and the last one occurred on a dark and stormy night. The daughter grabbed her candle and stomped up the stairs. As she reached the top, there was a horrific scream, and her body plunged down the stairs to land in a crumpled heap at the base beneath the lantern. One report suggests that the last argument with her father was too much, and she chose to end her life. Others reported that she tripped and fell over the low railing. Either way, the daughter's ghost still haunts this stairway on stormy nights. A flickering candle can be seen moving upwards, one stair at a time. Any witnesses to this paranormal event always say it ends the same way. A shriek followed by a second sickening thud at the bottom of the stairwell underneath the lantern. And it's getting hit because she's... Now, the death of his daughter caused the colonel to harden his feelings towards the British even more, and the report states that the colonel was haunted by his daughter's ghost and eventually stayed away from the Octagon. When the War of 1812 broke out, the Colonel Taylor moved his family to Mount Airy Plantation for safety and to escape the ghostly nightmare. He allowed the French minister to the U.S. to make the Octagon his official residence at that time. Many believe this is actually why the building was spared during the British invasion, and that basically burned most of Washington, including the White House. The French flag was actually flying over the Octagon when the British invaded, and after the British left, Colonel Taylor offered the house to President James Madison and his wife Dolly while the White House was being rebuilt. Madison's moved in the fall of 1814. They held several social events there to bolster the morale in the city as the war was not popular. And, of course, BC was starting to rebuild itself. When the war ended, Dolly Madison hosted the first social event, an open house, at the temporary executive mansion. Now, she knew how to throw a party. But it even said that at one of her parties, Aaron Burr scaled the back garden wall to meet with Dolly after he returned from his self-imposed exile in Europe. Of course, this is after the duel with Hamilton and his treason trial.
Well, after that, yeah.
Yeah. Now, Burr actually had once courted Dolly Madison, and he was the one who introduced Dolly to James. So, little history there.
Yeah.
Anyway, after the Madisons left the Octagon, more ghost stories started appearing in the local newspapers. Footmen dressed in full livery of an earlier period are seen hailing carriages of guests. The sounds of wheels rumbling over gravel roads are heard as the carriages roll away. Dolly Madison's ghost is also seen standing in front of the mantelpiece in the ballroom where she would often receive her guests. She is also seen as a wispy figure wearing a turban dancing through the entrance hallway. Now, the Taylor family moved back into the house after the Madisons moved out in 1815, and the tragedy, unfortunately, struck again. Another one of the Taylor daughters had eloped against the wishes of her father, and she returned one day to beg forgiveness. They met on the stairwell. Colonel could not forgive her for not marrying the gentleman a position that he had secured for her, and he went to move around his daughter. When he did this, she either lost her balance or drew back, trying to escape her father's touch. She tumbled past the colonel and fell dead at the foot of the stairs with a broken neck. It's difficult to understand what might have gone through the colonel's mind as the second daughter lays dead on the stairs. Many believe the repeated tragedies helped contribute to his own early death at the age of 57. Now, the second daughter also returns to the scene of her accident as well. Many people who visit the building unconsciously walk around the spot where she fell in a crumpled heap at the foot of the stairs. Others feel a cold spot there and vibrations, actually, in the air. The years of love and heartbreak at the Octagon seem to rest heavy on the former home to this very day.
Mm-hmm. And that's just a couple of little stories about the Octagon.
Yeah, there's plenty more.
It's a very, very haunted building, but those are the stories that we had.
The love story.
The love stories. So we might revisit the Octagon on a future episode to chat up some of the other stories that happen around the building there.
Yep. So now we're going to come back down to Virginia.
Yes. We are going to turn away from the capital, and we're going to go to not just Virginia, we're going to go to small town Virginia. And this tale comes from Rocky Mount in Southwest Virginia. And on January 22nd, 1892, a local newspaper published an article. Sorry, fire's being a little sassy. published an article called "The Course of True Love Never Runs Smooth." The first line of the article stated, "Miss Della Nichols and young Mr. Pickard have shuffled off the mortal coil because they could not be married." Della was 18 at the time and from a well-to-do family. Very little is known about Mr. Pinkard and the man she had fallen in love with. For some reason, both sets of parents objected to their union, leaving Della heartbroken. In true Romeo and Juliet fashion, she collected a rope and her younger sister as a witness. Della asked her younger sister to make sure her body was lifeless before telling her parents of her final act. On Della's first attempt, the rope broke. Rather than be dissuaded by a moment of clarity, as you might hope, her second try was successful. As word spread of Della's fate, it was just a matter of time before Pinkard found out. Once Pinkard learned of Della's death, he was inconsolable and took poison. He was dead within a few hours. In the years since the young lovers took their own lives, townspeople have since reported catching a fleeting glimpse of a young woman in white near the intersection of Floyd Avenue and Franklin Street. Older residents will speak of a woman in white who drifted around the lower end of town near that intersection. She never looked at anyone, and no one was ever able to approach her or see features in her face. She appears to wear a long white dress that some describe as a wedding dress, while others say it's just simply a nightgown. The sightings do continue to this day. After a tour given by the Franklin County Historical Society in 2005, a woman called and in a rather hysterical manner spoke of seeing a woman in white walking near the First Virginia Bank building at about 2 in the afternoon. She said the woman looked lost, so she went up to her, and the figure, without looking at the woman, vanished into nothingness. It seems Della's heartbreak was so deep that she could not find solace even in death. That little tale from our neighbors down the road in Rocky Mount.
Yep.
We're just bouncing all over the place.
Where?
We're making...
There was no connect the dots in this one.
No, well, there's connect the dots, but we're just making like a spider web. our next jump, we are jumping up to Maryland in this next one. We're actually going to be in Glenn's neck of the woods here. We are going to be in St. Mary's County, Maryland. And this tragic love story is said to have occurred in 1945. Again, in St. Mary's County, Maryland. We were just talking to. The legend starts with a young man being called to serve during World War II, and he leaves behind a wife who is expecting their first child. Shortly after the end of the war, he returns stateside, called his wife to say he had borrowed a car and was on his way home. He was anxious to meet his child, thus causing him to speed over the narrow, darkened road. His wife was also excited for the reunion and bundled up the baby before she started walking up Old St. Andrew's Church Road to meet her husband. As she approached the bridge with the child in her arms, her husband rounded a sharp curve on the opposite side of the bridge. He was roaring down the road, and by the time he spotted her, it was too late to stop. He hit her head on, killing her instantly, and the baby flew out of her arms and went over the side of the bridge. The body was never found. Since then, multiple witnesses crossing the bridge at night swear that they have seen the apparition of a young female running frantically back and forth searching for her lost child. The infant's cries seem to come from the black waters below, which has given it the name Cry Baby Bridge. Now, there is an interesting note about Cry Baby Bridge. The name probably rings a bell, and that's because this isn't the only Cry Baby Bridge. There are Cry Baby Bridges everywhere. This is just one of many such bridges that don't have earned that moniker. And almost all of them, though, do feature some origin story of children meeting untimely ends either on the bridge or in the waters beneath them. So in doing this, we found the Maryland. I think Maryland had several. Mm-hmm. Then there was Pennsylvania, and then I think out west, I think Utah had some or something like that.
There were several of them.
Texas had several.
I had to make sure I was all on the same bridge.
Talking about the right crybaby bridge. So many crybaby bridge stories to be had.
Say that 5 times fast when you didn't hurt
you. Yep. You want to take a break over?
Sure.
Here we go.
All right, so we're jumping back to Alexandria. We really need to get up to Alexandria and take those tours. So, in Fairfax, Virginia, there is a shop called A House in the Country. It was located in a 250-year-plus building that had a very tragic history. After the encounters with their resident female apparition, the shop owners invited a paranormal research team in to investigate the building and the history associated with it. They didn't know who their ghost was, they didn't know why she was there, and so they wanted the full deal. There was, unfortunately, a very tragic story that was discovered in the Alexandria Gazette that dated back to June 29th of 1868. The newspaper featured a story about Miss Laura M. Schaefer, the youngest daughter of Mr. Christian Schaefer, who was the well-known confectioner in the town at that time. Laura had been dressing for the evening in her room on the third story floor of her father's residence. Having finished dressing, she took the kerosene oil lamp to retrieve a handkerchief for the evening from the adjoining room. As she reached the other room, she heard the lamp crack and was instantly covered in the burning fluid. She threw the lamp into the hearth and ran downstairs screaming for help. Laura's brother-in-law, Mr. William Phillips, heard her cries and rushed into the house to witness her racing down the stairs, enveloped in flames. He wrapped her in his coat and smothered the flames, but Laura was severely burned. A doctor was sent for at once, and while he made his best effort to save her, she passed on in just a few short hours. About 3 hours after her death, Mr. Charles Tennyson, a young gentleman engaged to Miss Laura and her constant companion for many years, was sent from her deathbed and taken out for a walk by a friend, Mr. Green. The two walked down to Cameron Street and into the wholesale liquor store of Downham and Green. They shared a drink and a toast. Mr. Green then took the tumblers to the water stand and he heard a pistol shot. He turned to see Tennyson fall heavily on the floor and a five-barreled Whitney revolver in his hand. A surgeon was summoned, but Tennyson passed away about an hour later. Over the years, after the two deaths, the residents of the house and the shopkeepers that came later reported sensing or seeing a wispy image of a young woman descending the stairs in the building. The image is often accompanied by the distinct odor, of something burning. The investigation caught orbs in front of the house and a white image on the staircase. An electric decoration turned on by itself and was immediately followed by a burning smell, similar to burnt toast. The investigators believe that Laura is still there and she just simply desires some acknowledgement. They think that Laura is lonely and they advise the staff to simply give Laura a friendly hello from time to time.
Glenn actually says that he's only about 20 minutes from Crybaby Bridge, so he's familiar with it and he grew up with stories of Crybaby Bridge, so he's from Oregon.
What's the Are You Afraid in the Dark? I used to watch that.
Yeah, I used to watch it too, but Patrick was saying that the Crybaby Bridge inspired the Nickelodeon movie Crybaby Lane, which was a very dark and strange movie.
Oh.
And I was talking one of Nickelodeon's grim turns. But then, of course, there was also Are You Afraid of the Dark, which I watched every Friday night.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Love that show.
We watched it, and there was another show. I forget. It was that one. There was another show right next to it before we watched The X-Files right after that. So
there was also Weird Indiana at one point.
Weird. Never saw that one.
We never saw that one. That one was interesting. It looked at a lot of different possible folk tales and stories and legends.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so is this our last one? Yeah, this is our last tale for the night. And I thought this one was a sweet one to end with. This is kind of our happy story.
A little bit.
Kind of. I use it very loosely.
Whitney, Erie, Indiana?
Yes, Erie, Indiana.
Yeah, I never saw that one.
That one was interesting. It was very, very campy, but I liked it.
Well, it was Nickelodeon, right? Or no, something else.
No, it wasn't.
But it's geared towards kids?
Yeah, it was geared towards kids.
Okay.
Camping.
Spooky stuff that's geared towards kids. Campiness can have to be a part of it.
Yeah. This is where I started my spooky stuff.
Watched Ghostbusters every week when I was younger.
Mm-hmm.
When I, go to church on Sunday, come home from church, and pop Ghostbusters into the...
VHS?
No, actually, I think it was Beta.
You had Beta?
It was Beta. Yes. Yep. Fox Kids with Erie, Indiana.
Yep.
And also, Are You Afraid of the Dark and Goosebumps.
Yep.
But yep, and yeah, later Fox Kids and later ABC Family.
Mm-hmm.
So, miss those shows. They're good shows.
We need to get back to shows like that.
Yes, we do.
Less reality TV.
We've been watching a lot of Buffy. It's a little darker, certainly more grown up.
You've never seen Buffy. I introduced him.
Hey, we're more than halfway through. We're like, quarter of the way through season 5 now?
Yeah.
We're getting there. I know some really grim stuff's coming because there's been spoilers that I've been stumbling upon, but...
Yeah. I've been biting my tongue.
Yeah, well, I can't help but go ahead and look up characters and stuff like that, and then all of a sudden there's just this line that so-and-so died. I'm like, wait a second, what? No! And now whenever I see them there, it's like, you're going to die. That's sad.
Back to our story.
We have one more story. Yeah, so... This one comes from the Eastern Shore. So Eastern Shore Paranormal website talks of an incident involving a young man and his love. The young man escorted two young ladies to a nightclub, and while they danced the night away, he sat alone at a table, bored and depressed. A woman selling flowers at the club approached him, handed him a long-stemmed rose, and told him it was from a girl with long black hair who was in another section of the club. He got up to search for her, but found no one fitting the description. A few minutes later, after he had sat back down, a slow song was being played, and he had the strange sensation like someone was hugging him from behind. He looked around, but there was no one there. What shocked him more was that he recognized this hug. It was the way his fiancée used to hold him. His fiancée had died in a car crash in 1980, so it couldn't possibly have been her, but he needed to be sure. He called the flower lady back over to his table and took out a photo of his dead fiancée. She confirmed that this was the woman who had sent the rose. He took the rose home and placed it in a vase. It stayed fresh for about 3 weeks.
Pretty good.
A time later, he smelled a strong floral scent in his house when no flowers were there. He felt a presence and asked if it was his fiancée. He then stepped out onto the porch, and the pleasant scent was overwhelming. He believed people died, but love never dies. Those who love us watch out for us after they are gone and let us know that they are there when we really need them.
So comforting note to end on.
Yeah. We were pretty grim tonight. It was a theme.
Yeah.
Hey, we're not Valentine's people, but I love you.
I love you too.
There still can be romance.
Yes. All right, so 2 weeks from now, we're going to talk about presidential haunts and hauntings because it's going to happen on President's Day. Did we miss anything?
Whitney is Whitney shocked that I never watched Buffy before.
I'm schooling them.
I'm doing a lot of catching up now with the streaming services. You can catch up on so many of these shows that haven't been on the air in forever.
Years.
Yeah. Watching another one, really neat one that I'd never heard of before. It's on HBO right now from the BBC. It's called Torchwood. It's one from the mid-2000s. Good show so far. Finished season one. Very British. British don't hold back.
No, they don't.
The BBC doesn't have that pesky...
well, it depends on what year.
Yeah, well.
Lately, however, they don't
get that. Crazy. Anyways, but yeah. Are You Afraid of the Dark is also having a new miniseries premiering this month. Was not aware of that.
Need to look that up.
Yeah, it's a trailer or something on YouTube that Patrick had pointed to a link to. Kind of a semi-happy story to end with. Oh, and Patrick is saying Angel is better than Buffy in his opinion. We do plan on watching Angel as well. So
as soon as he split off the show, Chris is like, we're going to have to watch Angel.
Well, I'm really interested because, I'm interested in what happens with Angel, but then Cordelia also winds up going down there, and we haven't gotten to
Wesley's part. In there, too.
Wesley's there also. She's still on Buffy right now. Spike's playing
Harmony.
Harmony, yes. Harmony winds up going there, so it's like... These characters are neat. I want to see what happens to them. So, anyways, yes. But Patrick says that Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark premiering this Friday or next Friday.
Okay, well, I'll check that out.
It's only been a few decades, but apparently they're keeping their Friday night slot.
Great. I'll see if we can get it on streaming because no cable.
Yeah, that's all right. We'll figure it out.
Yep.
Whitney loved Drusilla. Drusilla is
scary. Oh, yeah. Chris and I actually are trying to figure out if there's a way we can do Drusilla and Spike for Halloween one year.
I just have to bleach my hair.
Not like you haven't done it before.
I know. It's just been about 20 years.
That or I need to be Vamp Willow. I really want to be Vamp Willow.
You could do that. You just have to dye your hair red again.
Oh, darn.
I could be Vampire...
Xander.
Xander. And Patrick, YouTube has it live.
Oh, okay, cool.
And Patrick got to see the actor that played Spike at Comic-Con.
Nice.
So,
James Marsden.
James Marsden, yes. Because, that other show I mentioned, the Torchwood show, at least one episode. It's only been one episode, but with the first episode in season two of Torchwood, he played a role in there. I don't know if he'll be back, but, yeah. Like, I know that guy. That's Spike. But it's not Buffy. It's a different show.
But yeah, another actor I would love to meet. I would love to meet Giles. Would love to meet Giles.
He seems like a nice guy.
Yeah.
How could he not be a nice guy? He's British.
Yeah. Giles can be my dad. He can be my second dad.
Anyways.
Yep.
Yes.
So with that, we'll see you all in 2 weeks. Stay safe with the weather and snow and more snow coming, and of course our lovely Virginia roller coaster with 50 degrees on Friday.
And before I forget to mention that, of course, we until midnight tonight we have we're having a snow day flash sale on tour tickets. So if you want to join us on any one of our tours this month in February, if you buy your tickets by midnight tonight and use promo code just snow. SNOW, when you go to check out, you'll get 25% off your tour tickets for February. So.
And yes, we are having a Valentine's Day tour.
Yes,
I'm giving that one if you want to come.
Yes. But other than that, so that's a special one. It's Sunday night. But other than that, we're doing tours on either just one a week, Friday or Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
We have five tours this month. So you have a couple that you could choose from. And if you want to join us, again, that offer does expire at midnight tonight. So if you want to take advantage of the 25% off, can go ahead and book soon. If you don't book soon, well, there's still tickets available.
Yep.
So.
And we'll be going back to Friday and Saturdays starting March. So.
Mm-hmm.
Starting to ramp it up again and come out of slow season.
Yep. Hopefully COVID cooperates. Fortunately, we're in a nice old house and surrounded by wood. We can knock on wood just about anywhere in here.
And wake the kittens up.
And wake the kittens up. Kittens are fine.
Yep. Okay. All right, so we're rambling. We will see you all later.
But we love talking to you.
Good.
So, and I have a little bit to drink. So
we can finish it up then.
Yes, we can finish stuff now. So, yeah, again, thank you again, as always, for tuning in. I look forward to hopefully seeing you back here in a couple of weeks when we do our
presidential haunts and hunting.
Yep, because we got President's Day, President's Week, whatever you want to call it, coming up later this month.
Yeah,
so.
And this is going to end up being a part one of many because...
Maybe we need to do part one, part two.
I think I've got enough for part three.
Okay, well, maybe our next two, unless you had one. Do we have one for two shows from now?
I don't know. I have to look at my list.
I think our shows kind of straddle President's Day, so one is before and the other one's going
to
be...
I have to look at my list.
We'll figure it out.
I can always push it back.
We'll figure it out.
All right. We'll see you all later.
Yep. Thanks again for watching, everybody. Y'all have a good night.
Like it's extreme.